We want to remind you that knowledge isn't power. Applied knowledge is power, where knowledge turns to experience. We encourage you to implement the information shared, allowing you to shift your health and energy. And if this is your first time listening, we truly appreciate you being here and would love to have your support by subscribing to our channel. We also love hearing from you, so please connect with us and share your thoughts. And if you have any ideas for future podcasts, please let us know. If you're interested in learning more about biological medicine or trauma-informed movement, check out the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to connecting with you in the future. Welcome to another episode of Connected with the Toms. I'm Julie, your number one trauma-informed movement coach.
And I'm Dr. Tom, sitting here in beautiful Arizona. It's fall, but it's still in the 80s and, you know, 30 degrees. It's like everybody's jealous because all the snowbirds are showing up now.
Right. Like, rub it in, Dad. It's not this weekend, Thanksgiving weekend for us. There was a little bit of snow in some parts of Canada. I was like, what? And the rain has come. The leaves are pretty, though. I got to say, we have leaves. We got lots of colors. The colors are so pretty. And it's a reminder. The season's changing. Remind us that it's, you know, it's time to shed some things. And it's a good time to check in under the hood. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Is we're going to check in on, we're going to talk about blood tests. And we're going to talk about different things that what happens when you go to the doctor and you get your blood tests and your doctor says, hey, all the numbers look normal, but you still feel like not good. You still feel something's off. So what can you do and what's actually happening? So Dad, this is going to be your wheelhouse because you're the doctor, but just on a personal experience, like for me, I went and got blood tests done recently from my doctor just to do a check-in. My body is changing a little bit and it's been a minute since I checked on things and went with the doctor and quickly went through all of my results and said, everything looks good. That being said, my vitamin D is a little bit lower based on the norms. He's like, you know, you could take some, but it's on the lower end. And my dad, as we talked about in the last episode, vitamin D is a big, it's a big important one. And that my numbers are much lower than my doctor really led me to believe. So something that I need to address, but also, you know, what did the numbers really mean? And what's really going on under the hood when I still feel like not very good and the numbers don't tell me anything. So Dad, I'm going to let you get us started and tell us a little bit about that. Cause I'm sure you can talk about lots of different things here. So where do you want to start? Where do you want to go?
Well, we'll just talk about the fact of when does somebody get a blood test? Usually, in medicine, people will go to their doctor, let's say for an annual exam, and the doctor will do some just routine tests. In Canada, they're a little more sparse than what we tend to do here in the United States for different reasons because of different healthcare system. And so why do you do a blood test? You do a blood test because it gives you a hint. It gives you a bit of a window into your metabolic systems that are going on. Theoretically, you know, since I was a professor for, 30 years almost, I would ask the students, I said, why are you doing this specific test? And so what you shouldn't be doing is you shouldn't be doing a blood test and the idea of trying to find a problem when a person's coming in who's ill. So that's one aspect of a blood test. But on the annual exam, people are just doing a screen. It's called a screen test. We do a complete blood count, which is, your white blood cells, red blood cells. We do a chemistry screen, which looks at your electrolytes and your liver function and your kidney function and your blood sugar and your cholesterol, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, those are the typical type things. So we'll back up and say where, and so what, you know, your doctor, as Julie just said, your doctor says, oh, everything looks pretty normal. You're fine. Come back next year and we'll do this again. So the problem that ends up happening is that we have to look at, well, where are these norms? What are you being compared to? And what are the reference ranges that you see on your report when your doctor gives you your report? So the first thing to know that when you do a blood test of any of these tests, you are being compared to 100 other people, in fact, 10,000 other people. And so the reference range, if you fall in the bottom 2.5% or the top 2.5% of your number, you will be considered that it is abnormal. In other words, only 5% of all blood tests are considered abnormal. irregardless of your state of wellness or the state of ill health in general. In other words, if you see something on your blood test report that is in black or somehow is pointed out, what it means is that you are either too high or too low of 2.5%. So you are not being compared to health. You are basically being compared to unhealthy people, which is how these norms are adjusted. And so, you know, as a physician, what we see on occasion, we get a report, we get a letter from the lab who's doing the report, and it says, we've adjusted our norms, and our norms are no longer between, you know, this number and this number. And we've now made the norms between this number and this number. So, well, how did that happen? And what happens is that they will take, like, say, 10,000 tests, and of the 10,000 tests that they've done, if more than 5% of those numbers fall outside of their reference range, they widen the reference range. So only 5% are outside the reference range. So in other words, forget it. Forget what the reference range says. It's not accurate. It's not health. It's not helpful.
Well, can I ask you just a quick question? So the is it based on people like my own age, or is it just like I'm a female and am I like, because the thing is, like, I don't want to interrupt you, but just something like that I've learned with tech, like Apple watches and whatnot, like tech gadgets, you know, like my heart rate range or heart rate variability, for instance, it's all based on men. Like the research is all based on the numbers are based on men. So for my blood test, what's the population that I'm looking at? Those 10,000 people, is it all females? Is it all males for me? Or is it just 10,000 people and they could be 20, they could be 50, they could be, how does that work? Do you know?
The reference ranges are based on women. The reference ranges are based on men. Okay. The reference ranges are based on children. And then there are some specific aspects, like women, specifically when we're doing hormones, whether you're in the follicular phase, whether you're in the luteal phase, whether you're premenopausal or whether you're postmenopausal, there are definitely different reference ranges, you know, depending on sex, age to some degree. But if you're 21 years old, or if you're, you know, 48 years old, there isn't much of a reference range there. If you're 1 year old, there is a difference versus somebody who is 21 year old. So there is, yes, there is compensation made in those types of things, because obviously those, as we're growing as children, will have different numbers than adults will in a variety of these. So they have made compensation, and, you know, okay, there's millions of people. But if you're a female, you basically are being compared to other adult females. If you're a male, you're being compared, with the exception of, let's say, testosterone in a 20-year-old boy, man, it will be very different than a 75-year-old man, because it changes. And one of the challenges when we look at hormones, of course, is the reference range is so wide, it's meaningless. It doesn't really tell you anything. It's like, it's pretty much useless. So doing a blood test for hormones is like, you might as well just blow smoke in the air and hope that maybe it'll tell you something. But there's much better tests to do than a blood test specifically for hormones. But these other, the CBC and ChemScreen lipids, are pretty standard numbers, and they've done so many millions of times that, you know, we have some indication of what the norm is. So instead of talking about reference ranges, I say you really want to be looking at optimal ranges. And without going into all details, because I teach an entire course on interpretation of labs, is the aspect of, you know, take the reference range, cut it in half, go 5-10% on either side of the mid range. And in many cases, that will give you sort of a preferred number to look for. Because, you know, if you are, let's say your thyroid, TSH, which is a common one in Canada, it seems to be the only thing they want to remember, test. Here in the United States, we actually test TSH, free T3, free T4, because it gives us a much more better indication of what your thyroid is doing, as opposed to just TSH, which we pretty much know doesn't tell us much of anything. Because the reference range for TSH, I have a patient who just sent me that from Canada, and I'll actually look at what her reference range is. And that's another thing. Once again, in Canada, you're using the metric system. In the US, we're using a different system. So the numbers will look a little bit different. So in Canada, this patient just had the reference range is from 0.4 to 5. This was a 65-year-old female who ultimately did this test. So her number came back at 0.65. Now, if her number had came back at 4.99, she's normal. But if it was, 0.41, she's normal. But do you really think that a person who's at 0.41 and a person who's at 0.49 are both the same? I mean, it doesn't make sense that the reference range is that way. But the reason the reference range is so wide is so that you don't have to treat. But the more ideal reference range, this one's a little bit different, is about 1 to 1.5. That's really from a TSH perspective, where ideally it would be per se. And if it's 4.99, as this one suggests, no, that's telling us that your hypothalamus is working hard to try and supply enough TSH to your thyroid gland to produce hormone. But we don't even know how much hormone is producing because they won't do the test in Canada. So the aspect of just an individual number is, remember, it's a glimpse in time. It's a moment in time. It's an actual moment in time. And I have in my seminar, I actually show lab tests, it's curious that it happens, but I have a number of patients literally within half an hour apart will do a blood test. I can think of one gentleman, he was in his internist's office. They did a blood test. He literally walked across the hall after that appointment. And his urologist also did blood tests. And so the blood was drawn, sent to the very same lab, taken same patient, 30 minutes apart. And it's like, it looks like it's two different patients. It's like, how can the numbers be so different in the same patient? Because it's a moment of time for what's going on. And so when you talk to the lab, they say, well, at any one moment, we can, the lab number, even if you drew this, did a test on that very same lab sample, it can be as much as 10% different. And so, I see this ad in United States on cholesterol, for example. No, it's Oatios or oats or oat cereal or whatever the cereal is in the United States that they're advertising. And the person is dancing around and saying, oh my God, my cholesterol went down. And I'm going to use an American number. It went down 15 points. And I said, well, in all honesty, sir, if we actually tested the same blood, the number could be greater than 15 points without taking any oats. So, the fact is that the numbers vary. And so don't stake your life on the number. The more important things about lab tests are the trends. It's the trend over time. It's not right. The specific moment. And so you really, by yourself, should be keeping track. You should have a spreadsheet with your labs that show you over time. And when they're changing over time, that's when it's getting really significant. If you're acutely ill, of course, that's a whole different ballgame. We're talking about just general screening that people are looking to try and prevent you from getting ill to see if the trend is that you're heading in a direction. And the most common one that I see a problem with is kidney function. We measure BUN, we measure creatinine, and we get what's called a GFR, glomerular filtration rate, which is a calculation for what's going on. And typically the GFR is considered to be greater than 60 is considered normal. But if you look at anything, I can't speak of the Canadian, I'm going to talk about the American. It is well known that your GFR is supposed to be greater than 90. So then why does it say it's normal if it's greater than 60? Because if it's 60, you're already in stage 2 kidney disease. But they don't do any, they don't say anything about it because they don't have anything to treat it. Like, we don't know how to treat it. And there's so wow. many people who are, 68, 72, 73. And so it's like, okay, so we need to make the person aware that your kidney is working harder. We need to be mindful of things that are potentially injuring the kidney. Are you being properly hydrated every day? Are you taking medications that maybe harden the kidney that have to be, and maybe that needs to be changed so we don't do so much. But generally speaking, until the numbers get down into the 30s and 40s, the doctor says, we need to be watching your kidney function. And then when it gets down in the 20s and 30s and 40s, they say, well, we have to go to the nephrologist now. We have to go to the kidney doc, because now they're going to look at it and they're going to look at it and say, well, we'll watch it. And when it gets down low enough, maybe we need to start dialysis. Or maybe you'll get to the point you'll actually need to have a kidney transplant, which, you know, it's a terrible thing to say. It's like, really? Is that the best we can do? Is just wait until it's totally broken, until we do something about it? So we need to be looking at lab tests over, not single, the numbers are, you know, it goes on the spreadsheet. But, you know, if you've been getting annual ones, you shouldn't just listen to your doctor and say it's fine. You need to keep track of them, put them on a spreadsheet, get it on your computer and look at it over time so that you can be seeing that, are you becoming more anemic? What is your, and another number that we doesn't get followed enough is your blood sugar, you know, and so often, and now that we have what's called continuous glucose monitor, I, in fact, routinely recommend this to many of my patients because their blood sugar will come back. Once again, I'm going to have to use American numbers. You know, we say it's below 100 is a norm. So so anyway, less than 100. So the person comes back and their blood sugar is 93. Oh, your blood sugar is fine. You're not diabetic. We do the so-called three-month average of their blood sugar, and it ends up being 5.1, 5.2. They say, oh, it's perfect. You know, until it gets over 5.7, you know, in that 5.7 to 6.2 range, it says now you're in the pre-diabetic range. And when it's over 6.2, now you're considered diabetic. Well, what I've been finding is that, you know, even a person who has, you know, a 5.2, 5.3, 3 month average of their blood sugar, or they have a blood sugar that's 93, let's say, or 87, said, oh, perfect, no problems, you're not in a pre-diabetic range. But because continuous glucose monitors are now easily accessible, they're inexpensive. And I was told in Canada, if you simply just, you know, you can go online and you can actually get one for free. I was told by a patient, you know,
for 2 weeks. Yeah, you can get one, yeah. And then you get 2 weeks of readings or whatever. And then after that, you have to pay. Because I have a client that did that. She's been really monitoring that. So yeah, you can get started. It's a great way because you just like put your phone up and then it gives you the reading right there and you can track it as often as you need and whatnot, for sure.
Absolutely. And so what we're finding is that even though it looks normal, I can think of one patient who has chronic migraines, and we were struggling to try and find some support and to see the pattern. And what we were finding, she was in Canada, her numbers were going down. Sometimes they were 3.8 and sometimes they were 8.5. And yet her A1C was like 5.1. So when you average it out, however, the fact that she had such poor blood sugar regulation was indeed a part of her migraine patterns that we couldn't figure out, as she was on a roller coaster. And even though just her standard blood test looked great, so the continuous glucose monitor, which you can do for 2 weeks, people start signing. It's like, oh my God, this woman went up to 8.2 or something. She said, but I didn't eat anything. So your blood sugar is not simply a function of what you're eating. It's a function of what you're doing. It's a function stress of your cortisol level, of your stress level, of your sleep, what you did that day. If, you know, you're worried about things, was that also will affect your blood sugar. And when your blood sugar is affected that way, it affects all your other metabolic systems. So people are lulled into this sense of security thinking, oh, my blood tests are all fine, I'm not a problem. And then they go the next time and they, oh, I hope my blood sugar is okay. It's like the continuous glucose monitor is well worth doing for 2 weeks and seeing. And if it's not on a roller coaster and it stays in a ref, good, you're under control. If it's down to 3.8 and then, you know, and this is Canadian numbers and up to 8.2, you know, per se, it's like, this is, even though you're so-called normal, you're not normal. We need to address all the other metabolic functions that are going on.
Actually, can I just ask a question? So what if I'm high, like what if I'm higher than that, but it fluctuates? So let's say if I go from like 15 to 10, is that, even though it's still high, is that like I'm fluctuating at a high level? Is that something
that's not good?
No. Okay.
No, it's not good because it's suggesting that you're basically an insulin resistance. And the higher these numbers typically are, it's typically more and more insulin resistance, which probably will have to be a topic in a few podcasts from now.
All right, I'm going to write that down.
Because it's such a common problem. You know, we used to think about it was only related to people who are overweight, type 2 diabetes. You know, it's head well, lose 25 pounds and your blood sugar will come under control. And it's, but that's a whole bigger topic that's beyond what we're going to talk about today in general. So, you know, we have these numbers that give you a false sense of security. Unfortunately, they're really not what we should be doing. They're not for health. They're just ballpark to make you think, oh, I better be paying attention to this. Please pull out all your old labs for the farther back. What I really like to see when somebody comes in who I've never seen before, you know, and let's say their A1C is 5.5. I'd say, can you show me something from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Well, I don't have those numbers. Well, start keeping track of numbers. Put them on a spreadsheet. And you're going to start to see it creeping up. And the more it's creeping up, the more we're moving into. And don't wait until it's broken to start treating it, because you want to basically make an intervention before you get to that point in time. And the same thing says whether you're anemic or, you know, your blood count is low, your white blood cells, red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit, et cetera, et cetera. So we look at trends. It's not from, you know, one test. It's like, oh, your hemoglobin is a little bit low, your blood sugar is a little low, et cetera. But blood sugar over time is important to track. Your GFR, which is your kidney function, is important to track. And you know, we have liver enzymes. Liver enzymes are a bit of a joke for most part, because unless you have hepatitis, your liver doesn't show change in liver enzymes until about over 80% of the liver is affected. So people say, oh, my liver enzymes are just fine. I can tolerate alcohol. I can tolerate, you know, the 500 things that the liver is doing by putting these chemicals or whatever I'm being exposed to, whether it's environmental chemicals or food chemicals or nutritional chemicals or medicinal chemicals. So the liver is an organ, which is why we suggest castor oil packs, whether or not you think your liver is working or not, because it's a friend to your liver, to your entire digestive system. So that, once again, it just shows the aspect of the inadequacies of doing a single test. The best liver test that's not typically done to really see if your liver is affected is called GGT. It's a short form, because that is the one that specifically is affected by alcohol. And if you don't tolerate alcohol well, I'd almost guarantee your GGT, you drink alcohol, almost guarantee your GGT will be high, because it's the one. The other, your AST, ALTs, which are common, alkaline phosphatase, which is a common marker, bilirubin is a common marker for that, you know, and there's, so I'm not going to get into how we diagnose things, but these are all common things and usually they're fine. If they're elevated, you know, they say, oh, we should check you for hepatitis because it's the most common thing they check for. And one time I asked an internist, you know, the reference range for, let's say, the standard enzymes are from, you know, 10 to 50. So I said, well, what do you do if it comes back, it's 80? And he says, well, we typically will say, well, let's wait 3 weeks or three months and we'll test it again. Oh, okay. Well, what is 123? Well, we'll test it and for hepatitis. You don't have hepatitis. Well, what do you do then? We don't do anything because we don't have anything to do. We don't have any drug to give you to lower your enzymes. We'll just say maybe it'll get better on its own. I said, well, why don't you make your number from 0 to 500? He said, yeah, that would make more sense, because then we wouldn't recheck anybody, because, you know, only when it's really, really high do we hepatitis become a factor. So that they know that it's a way that we don't have to actually talk about the problem, because if we don't have a treatment for it. And that's the same reason why the GFR has a reference range that says greater than 60, as opposed to what it really should say is greater than 90. Now, I'm not saying that some doctors don't pay attention to that, but more often than not, the number greater than 60 is what it is, or it won't even tell you the number. It'll just say it's greater than 60. And you don't know if it's 61 or if it's 79. It's like the lower the number, not good. We want GFR to be high, meaning your kidneys are actually functioning fairly normal. And then we have the old bugaboo of cholesterol. The most common one that doctors seem to like to latch onto, the one that they seem to want to, you know, get people all hot and bothered about, somehow thinking that cholesterol is, you know, is the problem, and it's the, and it'll increase your risk of heart disease or cardiovascular. And it is true that there is a component. I'm not going to totally dismiss it for what's going on. However, it is important to know that 80% of your cholesterol is self-manufactured. It has nothing to do with your diet. Less than 20% of your total cholesterol number is related to what you're eating. And so people say, well, I don't eat red meat. I'm not eating eggs. I'm not eating foods supposedly that are high cholesterol foods, but yet my cholesterol is still high. I said, well, that's because your body is making it. Well, why is your body making it? Well, because what is cholesterol? Why does the body make 80% of your cholesterol, which tells you that it's an important nutrient in your body? And we shouldn't be trying to necessarily drive our cholesterol down per se, because cholesterol is the backbone. It's the for every single cell in your body. And every single day, we are making 330 billion new cells. 330 billion new cells need some bricks to build the cell, per se. So we need that cholesterol because it's the backbone for building the cell wall. In addition, cholesterol is the backbone for most of your hormones. And, you know, we see people trying to drive their cholesterol levels so low that you can't make any hormones. And the 60-year-old man comes in and says, I have no testosterone. I need a prescription to inject it so it goes up. And then you look at his cholesterol and he's on a statin drug and his cholesterol is like 90. I say, well, you have no raw material. How are you supposed to make it if you have no building blocks to make the hormone? So there's a give and take. It's on a teeter-totter for what's going on here. And so is cholesterol really the bugaboo that we need to be concerned about? If we go back 100 years or 120 years, in 1900, the average cholesterol was about 250, which in the U.S. we use 200 as the top end of norm. So 250 to 300. Why? Because they ate lard and, you know, it's like the body needed it to make these hormones because people weren't being given hormones and, you know, that kind of thing. So now we look at the most common reason that cholesterol is elevated is in my patient population. I will clarify, it is my patient population. It is rare. In fact, it's almost never what they're eating. Because their diet, they have a pretty high level of consciousness, I would say, in general. However, what they are having problems with when we look at their heart rate variability is like your nervous system is considerably out of stress and you are living in this place of sympathetic dominance, meaning that you're in flight or fright constantly. So your body is constantly thinking that you're needing to prepare yourself. And one of the functions of chronic flight or fright when cortisol and epinephrine are elevated are to raise your cholesterol because it's raising LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol. There's no such thing as bad cholesterol. And we say, well, why did the body make this mistake? Like why are we making this LDL? Because, you know, before the era of hospitals and doctors, if you had an accident, if you were attacked by the saber-toothed tiger and had a wound, you know, and you couldn't go to the doctor and get it, you know, sewn up, what the body said, I'm going to plug the hole myself. And literally, it will raise your LDL level to plug the hole. So there are people who get very nervous about, you know, going to have their blood drawn. You know, they have an anxiety or a fear about the blood draw for whatever reason. And so literally, or they're on their way, they fasted overnight, they haven't eaten anything for the last 12 to 14 hours. You know, their level should be at their baseline, but they're on the way to the lab or to their doctor's office, they see an accident or they're almost in an accident or somebody runs a red light and their stress goes way up. Per se, or they're thinking about something, they're thinking about, you know, what their child just happened, or their grandma is ill, or, you know, whatever. And that's the state that they're in. In other words, they're in a state of sympathetic dominance. That will raise your LDL 25 to 30 points, irregardless that you've fasted. But just that is, so it's an inaccurate measurement unless you're truly in a relaxed parasympathetic place to truly find what your baseline is. But we accept that fact, that we know that that's the case. But doctors say, oh, your cholesterol is a little bit too high, we'll put you on the statin. And all that does is it prevents your body from reabsorbing cholesterol back into your body, you know, in general. So I generally pay not too much attention to the actual number, but more attention to their heart rate variability, more attention to, yes, we look at their diet, more attention to how they manage their stress. And in fact, recently I had to renew my CPR, which we have to do every couple of years as a physician in the state of Arizona. And the paramedic who basically taught the course, I specifically asked them, I said, how much do you find with the calls that you go on where people are having a heart attack has to do with their cholesterol level? He says, in all honesty, we hardly pay attention to it anymore because we're finding that the number is not very important. And so now what's becoming more prevalent and now what's becoming more common is for people to do what we call their calcium score, which is a CT scan of their heart, of their vessels. And you actually see if they have plaques in their coronary arteries. And he said, depending on what that number is, that is a much more accurate and much greater indication of whether or not potentially you have the potential of having a cardiovascular accident. Statin drugs have been around forever. It is, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the most widely prescribed medications there are in the westernized countries. And the research has shown that it supposedly will reduce your risk of heart disease or having a heart attack. Some of the research says, however, it mostly reduces if you've already had one heart attack. And so if you have already had a heart attack, survived, hopefully, obviously you would be listening to this if you didn't, then the statin drug probably will be of some benefit. However, just lowering the number for the most part has shown that it doesn't really change your risk unless we deal with all these other factors of your cardiovascular system, of your stress level, of your heart rate variability, et cetera, et cetera. So now I'm recommending that people ask their doctor if they will actually have them order a calcium score, and gives us a much better indication of what your potential risk is in the future of having a cardiovascular accident. And that, and according to the paramedic, he says that gives us a much better indication of the people who are at the greatest risk of doing this. In addition to all this, and I would say just from a heart attack perspective, in my experience, the people who generally have had a heart attack almost invariably, and once again, it's my patient population, it's not very difficult to discern that in the previous 6 or 12 months, there have been a significantly heightened level of stress that they've been under. They have an ill parent that they've been looking after, or their job has become more difficult, or maybe they lost a job, or they lost a family member, or, I mean, there's a number of factors that have just piled up, and they're basically living in flight or fright. Their sleep is not very good because they're worried. So they have almost usually several other components that are a part of this picture, and they are much more susceptible because they're putting all this extra strain on their heart muscle, we'll call it. And then that becomes, you know, the main focus of support ultimately that they need. So are statins a necessary evil? Well, there are some people who will benefit from it. But in general, if you followed the recommendations throughout these 30 plus podcasts that we've been talking about for the last few years, you will have a lot of tools in your toolkit that will actually support you. And that may not be your best choice. We know that when you start interfering with metabolic pathways, there's always a consequence. And one of the things that's a consequence, of course, is breakdown of muscle tissue. And so there are some people who can't take muscles because they have, you know, muscle breakdown and they have a lot of muscle pain. And they said, I don't know why I have muscle pain and muscle cramps. And the doctor says, oh, maybe. And so if you are taking a statin, please, 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 please make sure you are also taking coenzyme Q10 because it is interfering with that particular pathway. And if you have sore muscles and fatigue and are taking a statin and are not taking CoQ10, you may find that you get a dramatic improvement by simply adding, you know, 50 or 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 into your daily regime as far as your nutritional support is concerned. So these numbers of labs are give many people a false sense of security. They are important. I do them on every patient because I need to know where they're starting. And I usually request previous labs to see trends. And of course, my preference is that I see people over a very long time, including 20, 25 years. And it's very easy to follow them over that period of time. And many of my patients bring their spreadsheets with them showing, what their trends have been over many, many years. And that's really what is the most indicative of their health level and how important these tests are on an ongoing basis that, we need to be talking about for their specific health. Remember, it's not a health screen. It's a metabolic screen that just puts you in the ballpark, but it'll never get you to home base. It may leave you in the outfield per se, still so-called in the norm range, but not in the health range. And we want people at home base. We want people to be in their optimum level of health, meaning that their metabolic screening markers are really at an optimal range in their, and that you can do on your own more or less from just taking the halfway point, but plus or minus 10%, which would give you definitely a ballpark figure.
That was a lot. So the one question that keeps coming up for me though is, so I should be taking blood tests, what, once a year or once every 2 years? Is there a preference?
It depends on your age. Younger people, certainly every couple of years is generally fine, especially if you're following the guidelines we've laid out.
How do you define younger?
20s. The 20s.
Okay. When I hit 30 plus, I want to start doing it once a year?
That's what I suggest.
Okay.
I'm looking at these trends, and these trends are important because people's lives are changing. You look from year to year, COVID aside, pandemic aside, even before COVID, I've been in medicine for 50 years. So it's like I've seen people so many things have changed over those 50 years in medicine. Things in medicine have changed significantly. Our lab values have changed over those 50 years, just from blood pressure. And people always laugh. When I was in dental school, literally 54 years ago, when they talked about blood pressure, they said, your average blood pressure, believe it or not, 54 years ago, was the top number was 100 plus your age. And the lower number was under 90. So if you were 80 years old, your blood pressure 179 over 89 was normal. Now, of course, people absolutely would freak out because now it's supposed to be, under 120 over 80 and less. And it's like, and so whether you're 21 years old or 80 years old, we're using the same norms. Now, it does make, and so there's a lot of things that have changed in those 54 years, per se. Obviously, 189 over 89 is there's some big problem going on. And interesting, once again, in my patient population, almost invariably what I find is you're treating the wrong system because they may have tried 5 different hypertension meds and it's not going down. It's not their kidney or their cardiovascular system that needs the support, which is what the medications mostly focus on. It's their nervous system that needs the support because the nervous systems have changed over those 50 years. And that's really what's driving people's blood pressure up. There are other issues for sure, but just as these are generic statements in general, I always, always, always treat the nervous system in any patient who has high blood pressure, even if they're on high blood pressure meds. And then what I found clinically, it's one of the medications that people over time invariably will reduce their dosage and or get off because of the fact that once their nervous system comes more into balance, their body doesn't have to keep thinking, and why is the blood pressure going up? Because the brain is saying, I need more oxygen. I need more oxygen to be able to think about all the things that I'm trying to deal with on an everyday basis. And if we're doing our breathing exercises and doing our nebulizer and doing our things to improve our lymphatics and our head. You know, sometimes the brain says, oh, I got plenty of oxygen and I don't have sleep apnea. It's like, which is a whole other issue. Why people have high blood pressure because they have sleep apnea. They don't breathe at night. They don't have enough oxygen. Their high blood pressure has to go up to get more oxygen up into their head. So, I mean, we have all these confounding factors. And it's not just, oh, you take your blood pressure. Did you sleep well? What's your stress level? What are you doing on an everyday basis, et cetera, et cetera. So many, many things have changed over all those years. And we need the trends over time, especially for blood sugar, especially for your kidney function. This GGT enzyme is one that should be routinely measured, in my opinion, but it's not part of the so-called liver panels unless you specifically ask for it. At least that's the case in the labs that I use, so I specifically always ask for it. Cholesterol is the bugaboo that people want to sort of, you know, oh, your cholesterol's a little bit high, maybe we should consider a statin. It's like, or maybe lose some weight and change your diet. We'll check it again next year, and if it's still a problem, this would be the option. But it really doesn't have to be the option for what it is. And there are other, you know, types of tests that are routinely done, depending where you are. C-reactive protein is another one that's an indicator that's just a sign of inflammation. Highly sensitive CRP, normally we want it less than one. You know, between one and three is like moderate. And then over three, supposedly you have an increased risk, once again, of just general inflammation. But when I look at cardiovascular illness on labs, I just don't look at your cholesterol level. I look at your ferritin level. It's an indicator. I look at your A1C as an indicator. I look at your platelet level as an indicator. Obviously, I look at your cholesterol level as an indicator. I look at your homocysteine level also as an indicator, which is not routinely measured by most doctors. And when we take those five markers, and even we can add fibrinogen, we got a pretty good idea. And if somebody is really interested, then we say, let's do a CT score, calcium score of your cardiovascular vessels. And we'll really give you a really pretty accurate idea of what your potential risks are having an accident down the road. So that's a lot. It's a mouthful.
It is. But I find it's all interesting information. So basically, you know, when I do sit down with my doctor, what I should be really doing is comparing how I was the last time, instead of the you know, when I sit down with a doctor, getting my test results, what I want the doctor to do is like, this is where you were last time, this is where you are this time. And that's really what we want to be doing, and not necessarily just looking at, you know, do I fall into the norms that are on the sheet? Because it's funny, because as you're talking, I'm looking at my own tests, and sure enough, it says there, like, these ranges have changed, or we assess this, whatever, we're using a new measuring tactic or tool to measure stuff. So they're telling us that things are changing. So absolutely. So basically, when you sit down, it's more of like, use this as information. Your blood test is more just gathering more information as to what's going on. But again, why would you take a blood test? Well, you need to know what's going on under the hood, right? So, you know, if your doctor's saying, yeah, everything's okay, but you still feel like crap, well, it's because we haven't looked at you need to step back and look at a bigger picture. We need more information, right? So when you're talking about blood pressure, right. I have a client, she has high blood pressure and she's had it for a long time. But if you talk to her about her trauma history, oh, there's a lot. There's been a lot of things. And so we've been talking about, you know, her nervous system, and understanding like when she takes her blood pressure, it's different from when she takes it from her right arm and her left arm. And that's something to understand, that, you know, like, how do you always take your blood pressure? Because when we are stressed, the right side and the left side respond differently. So there's just different things that we've been exploring, and she's noticing that we can shift her blood pressure in ways when we really tap into the emotion piece. And so that's been really fascinating, because it's just been something that we've been doing, and it's been very front of mind when we meet, because that she's very worried about her blood pressure and her family history is, you know, she has three family members who have dropped dead of heart attacks at different ranges. So she's very worried. It's a very real thing for her. But we've been talking about, you know, how do we help her nervous system and not just rely on this drug? Because a lot of times when you're taking statin drugs, you know, it's just a Band-Aid, right? It's just in the meantime, like, what are you doing? Like you have to go a little bit deeper. Like my dad said, like, how is your breathing and how is your stress levels and how is your diet and how are the other factors that are influencing it? So you got to take a take a minute to do that. But the blood test definitely gives you that moment in time. Here I am. And now let's start comparing it to where you were last year and where you're going to be next year and go from there. So like I said, I was analyzing all of my numbers, but your numbers are different from mine. So like, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, figuring out, just looking at it, it doesn't necessarily give me information. So we need a little bit, we need to gather a bit more information is what I'm seeing or what I'm hearing. So.
And it, once again, what you said is key. Look back, look for previous tests, get them on a spreadsheet, keep track of them yourself. Remember, we have to be our own best health advocates. Don't rely on your doctor or your healthcare team to be paying attention. They're dealing with hundreds of different patients all at the same time. They obviously are doing the best job that they possibly can. But if we're not our own best health advocate, we may be missing an opportunity to truly head a problem off. And whether it's in your kidney function, whether it's your lipid levels, whether it's your blood sugar, blood pressure, all those types of markers, really pay attention to for yourself, pay attention to what your body is telling you, knowing that the symptom is never your problem, but simply an indication that there is something that it's out of balance. And that's what a physician is trying to help you with, trying to figure out why your body is not in balance, why it's not in homeostasis, and what are the factors that are required to help you get back there by supporting your own physiology, as opposed to going against your own physiology, which is what a lot of treatments are based on, stopping the reaction. Just like we talked about in our previous podcast about, you know, taking something for a cold or flu. Don't stop your fever, support it. Don't stop your mucus discharge, support it. Don't stop your cough, support it in a whole variety of different ways as much as we possibly can. Same thing to be said about blood tests.
Right on. So we're in the support business, Dad. It's all about how do we
business.
Yeah, that's what we're here. We're here to support your healing and support your own bodies, right? So the body has all the wisdom, right? We've heard it before. There's so many quotes on that, but your body has all the wisdom and knows how to heal itself. So we just need to get out of the way. So stop using your cognitive brain and your prefrontal cortex and be like, I know better. Let your body guide. And that's really what we're all about. And that was awesome. Thank you. Well said, Dad.
Okay.
Are there any other final thoughts that you want to add on, or that was pretty good? You summed that up really well.
That sounds like diarrhea of the mouth on lab tests.
well, it's just, there's a lot of information though, because
yeah, there's a ton of information. I teach a whole course that takes right. 7 or 8 hours on the intricacies of these numbers. So that's a very snapshot good. Of things that, you know, you don't need to know all the details. That's for your practitioner, but it should give you hopefully a clue and some ideas that don't be lulled into a false sense of security that just because your doctor says everything looks fine. Fine is not health. Optimal is much closer to what we're really trying to support you with through these podcasts.
Right. And optimal is for you. Like you have your own story. Right. So what is optimal for you? And you got to know your own body. So this is just another reminder that get in the driver's seat. You know your body best. And here's just some information that we can, you know, start moving forward. So if you haven't had a blood test done in the last year, highly recommend that you go get one. And then we can start the process of gathering more information to help you live more optimally at the end of the day. Right.
Awesome. So, excellent.
So that actually leads into our next podcast, though, because we're going to talk about autoimmune diseases and why does your body tend to turn against itself, and dive into like, why are food sensitivities up on the rise? Like, Dad, I think one of your first books was all about food sensitivity. Was it your first book on food sensitivity? First one was all about food sensitivity. How long ago was that? 30 years ago?
Over that. It was 1990. So what's that? 23 years ago. Yeah, no, 33 years ago.
Whoo. Well, it's funny because like that book, I remember I was going in for a massage a few, like this is probably, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. I was going in for a massage. It was a massage therapist was sharing an office with a naturopath. I walk in and I right there on the desk is my dad's book. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So that naturopath was using my dad's book for food sensitivity. So I thought that was pretty cool. So that book is, I think you still get it on Amazon, I think now. Yeah, I think it might be on there.
It's on my website.
On the website, yeah. And they've changed the cover. And anyway, it's all good. So we're going to talk about why are food sensitivities on the rise and autoimmune diseases. specifically, and why does your body feel like it's turning against you? So we're going to talk about that in our next podcast. So thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you sharing your time with us, and we hope you have a beautiful day.
We'll talk again.